Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Tarps are meant to provide protection in a storm. That's certainly the case for the federal government's Troubled Asset Relief Program. The banking industry's already got half the TARP money covering its collective assets. Now it's time to figure out what to do with the other half. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing people-ready enterprise solutions, software based on how people really work, and by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing, constantcontact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 12th of January. $350 billion down, $350 billion to go. Today, in a game of high-stakes telephone, President-elect Barack Obama asked President Bush to ask Congress for the second half of the bailout money. But it's clear that banks will have to jump through a few more hoops to get the cash this time. No more unrestricted handouts. But there's an even more basic question underlying the latest TARP request. Do banks really need more taxpayer money? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
When banks got the first half of the bailout cash, they took the money and sat on it. They didn't lend it out. Now the credit crunch is easing a bit, but that's at least partly because of behind-the-scenes maneuvers by the Fed. It's pumped billions of dollars into the banking system. So should President-elect Obama give any of the remaining bailout money to banks?
I hold up my hand and say, I don't want you to do that.
Alan Sinai is chief economist of the research firm Decision Economics.
The banks won't lend it to the private sector. We won't get any benefit from it.
Diane Casey Landry says that's not true. She's chief operating officer of the American Bankers Association. She says banks are just more picky about who they lend to.
You have to have the capacity to repay that loan. This is not intended as a giveaway program.
Casey Landry says banks have increased their lending. She says any new Treasury money would be lent out. But consumer advocates say current loans are being used to refinance existing mortgages for those with good credit scores. The banks aren't helping struggling homeowners avoid foreclosure. John Taylor heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He says banks won't help struggling consumers unless they're given an ultimatum.
You must be willing to assist the government in modifying these loans to match the borrower's ability to pay.
Economist Alan Sinai says the government has been too lenient with banks. So all Congress can do now is learn from its mistakes. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If banks won't modify mortgages, maybe judges will. That's the idea behind two nearly identical bills making their way through the House and Senate. They'd give federal bankruptcy court judges the power to rework the terms of mortgages headed into foreclosure. They could adjust interest rates or even reduce the principal on loans. Lenders have opposed these bills for years. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us, the idea is gaining momentum on the Hill.
The bills allow federal bankruptcy court judges to slash interest rates and principal for homeowners who file for bankruptcy. Backers say this could keep millions of Americans from losing their homes. But similar bills stalled in the House and Senate last year. And opponents like Scott Talbot at the Financial Services Roundtable say allowing judges to reduce mortgage payments would cost banks a lot of cash. Those banks will have no choice but to pass on their losses.
Through higher interest rates, higher down payments, higher closing costs, or all three.
But some academics say foreclosures actually cost banks even more.
Losses in foreclosure are going to be much greater than losses in modification.
Adam Leventon's a bankruptcy professor at Georgetown University Law School. He says right now, mortgage servicers that collect payments for banks often fail to renegotiate home loans, even when that would ultimately save lenders money. Why? Because it doesn't pay.
But if they foreclose, the servicer is able to collect any fees that it can levy. And this gives servicers a great incentive to lard on all the fees they can. These fees get paid off the top in a foreclosure.
Leventon says the bill would let bankruptcy judges cut mortgage servicers out of the equation entirely. keep more Americans in their homes, and could even save banks billions. Many bankruptcy judges say they like that idea. And with President-elect Obama about to assume office, even the bill's opponents say it's likely to become law. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The financial world is abuzz today at the prospect of a multi-billion dollar deal between two Wall Street giants. Citigroup is expected to announce a merger of its famous Smith Barney brokerage with Morgan Stanley. The deal could garner $2 to $3 billion for Citi, and with its stock down 17% just today, the bank could certainly use the cash. But what's Morgan Stanley getting out of the deal? And where is it getting the money to buy Smith Barney? From taxpayers? Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
The first thing former SEC counsel Mercer Bullard thought when he heard news of the buyout, the $10 billion Morgan just received in the bailout.
I think the idea of the $10 billion was to solve liquidity problems. And one certainly wouldn't think that the liquidity problem was the inability to raise enough cash to buy a brokerage.
But some analysts say Morgan Stanley is using its bailout money wisely. It could end up with the biggest retail brokerage in the world. There's a risk, though. As a Wall Street Journal blogger put it, what if the bear market persists? Morgan could be stuck with 20,000 retail brokers sitting around watching CNBC all day. But banking analyst Nancy Bush says in these touch-and-go times, sitting on your hands is risky, too.
And actually, the timing is probably, in a ironic sense, good, because you don't want to try to buy into these businesses when things are great. You want to buy into them when the outlook is uncertain and, you can get them on the cheap.
This deal could inspire even more consolidation in the U.S. banking business, but customers at Smith Barney and Morgan Stanley probably won't notice a thing. NYU finance professor Inga Walter.
I think the customers have no cause for concern. They can continue to deal with their own broker. They're dealing with a first-rate firm.
Walter has been a Smith Barney customer since the 70s. Since then, he says, the brokerage has had 12 different names. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street caught a case of the Monday blues today on an inglorious start to earnings season. We'll have details when we do the numbers. As we reported earlier in the show, there are signs the Obama administration will be modifying the goals and conditions of the government's $700 billion bailout package. It could spell change for banks that assumed they would get a second slice of that pie. Many got a first slice, despite being relatively healthy. And critics now want to know why they got the cash and what they're doing with it. Tom Bonsi posed those questions to some regional banks in the Pacific Northwest.
You can look up the list of bailout recipients on the U.S. Treasury website. On top are struggling behemoths such as Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch. But as you move down the list, you find solid, upstanding community bankers, people you might know from some place like Rotary Club. Take Michael Sand. He runs Timberland Bank, headquartered in the mill town of Hoquiam, Washington.
We felt it was just a good time to add capital to the balance sheet, given the uncertainty in the economy.
Did you need a bailout?
Oh, absolutely. We did not need a bailout. We're very strongly capitalized as a company, one of the more highly capitalized companies in Washington state.
So why then is this healthy bank and dozens like it getting federal cash?
It's likely that banks will increase their lending based on their confidence that they have the capital to adequately support the lending.
This is a typical story of the over 250 American banks that got Treasury cash in exchange for preferred stock. The Treasury Department quickly abandoned its initial idea to buy troubled assets from struggling banks. Treasury says the revised approach primes the pump quicker.
They're buying into institutions that are strong. So it's really not a bailout. What it is a buy-in.
Ray Davis is CEO of a regional bank out of Portland called Umpqua Bank. You're right if you hear a little frustration there with how the bailout, or buy-in, has been run and spun. Davis hears people accuse banks of just hoarding their federal infusions to bolster their bottom lines.
No, we're not sitting on it. We're trying like crazy to get it loaned out. It's in our best interest to loan it out. I mean, banks make money by loaning money out at a rate that's higher than what they're paying out.
Umpqua and other banks have to pay out a 5% dividend on the Treasury money, but bailout watchdogs are troubled with how little else the contract demands.
We we don't think there were enough strings on the money that went out in the first $350 billion.
Ryan Alexander is president of the group Taxpayers for Common Sense.
We have no benchmarks where we're saying we gave you $40 billion, so we want to make sure that you continue to lend to small businesses, that you continue to make sure that your commercial paper is moving. I think it's very hard to tell whether or not the bailout's working.
Patience, says the bank president in Oregon. He says credit markets are slowly getting unstuck. He's prepared to report he's making all his standard loans, including mortgages.
Banks are still required by the same regulators to make sure that they're loaning the money in a very safe and sound manner, responsibly. They're not just throwing money out, you know, the car window as they drive by the street.
Davis is pretty sure that we taxpayers will profit from the bank investments. He notes the government bought its bank stakes when prices were depressed. The stakes will presumably be worth considerably more when they're redeemed in better times. In Olympia, Washington, I'm Tom Bonsi for Marketplace.
As if the economic crisis and credit crunch weren't bad enough for the banking sector, now comes word that some of them are looking the other way as money is funneled from questionable sources into the U.S. Several British banks, including the venerable Lloyd's of London, are under investigation for helping their customers in countries like Iran, Libya, and Sudan get around U.S. sanctions. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from the British capital. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
So we've got these nine European banks that are said to be under investigation for violating sanctions. What exactly are they alleged to have done?
Stripping is what it's called. We're talking here about the practice of removing key details from an electronic money transfer to disguise where the money has come from. And it's alleged a bunch of European banks have been doing this to break US sanctions, to send money from countries like Iran, Libya and Sudan into the United States without the U.S. banking system being able to detect where the money had come from.
Well, without getting into the nitty-gritty of it, how exactly does this work? Are they sending it from these countries through other countries and then into the U.S.?
Yes, that's precisely what they're doing. And we don't know too much detail at this stage of precisely how many different countries these transfers went through or how much money is involved. But we're clearly talking about many hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, in the one case which has emerged publicly now, Lloyd's, a major British bank, has admitted that it illegally transferred $350 million, most of it from Iran, into the U.S. banking system using this technique to disguise where the money came from.
So if Lloyd's has admitted $350 million and we've got eight other banks, we're probably looking at billions.
Exactly.
For what purpose?
We simply don't know. I mean, we may know soon, however, because Lloyd's has done a deal with the U.S. authorities so that none of its executives go to jail over this. They're paying a fine, $350 million. But crucially, they've also agreed to open up their records to the U.S. authorities so they can follow the money trail. They can find out where this money came from in Iran and where it wound up in the U.S.
So the natural question is whether this is part of the terrorism money trail. Is there any evidence that this cash has been funding terrorism, buying military equipment, anything of the sort?
Well, again, the details are very hazy, but there are some signs of something sinister in connection with the inquiry. Emails from Iran have emerged in which Iranian interests are seeking to buy huge quantities of tungsten. One order alone, apparently, was for 30,000 tons of the metal. Now, as I understand it, tungsten is used in the manufacture of long-range missiles, and it's also used to make fridges. So ask yourself, why did Iran need 30,000 tons of tungsten, for fridges or for missiles?
All right, I guess we'll look forward to a possible answer on that question. Stephen Beard talking to us from London. Thanks so much.
Okay, Tess.
Coming up, learning how to do more than just scrape by.
Someone has the underlying belief of, I don't deserve to have money. it doesn't matter if you can find 10 extra dollars in their budget to go to their credit card. That's the underlying issue.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors looked hard for encouraging news today and found the cupboards bare. Instead, straight talk from Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, fourth quarter earnings jitters, and worries about the financial sector sent U.S. stocks tumbling. The Dow fell 125 points, almost 1.5%, to close at 8,473. The Nasdaq slipped 32 points, 2%, landing at 1538. The S&P lost 20 points, 2.25%, wrapping up at 870. Talks between Morgan Stanley and Citigroup about combining their brokerage units yielded poor results. Morgan Stanley lost 1.4%. As we told you earlier, Citigroup plunged 17%, the steepest drop on the Dow. Bond prices fell, nudging the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for November. The Senate Committee on Foreign Relations holds a hearing on the nomination of Senator Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. And in Denver, Colorado, it's all about beef at the International Livestock Congress. The theme is Global Beef, Meeting the Demand. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Time Warner's AOL is giving itself a service upgrade that some are calling a major transformation. It's consolidating all its web zines under a single unit. The new strategy could lead to more advertising dollars. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from the Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
For some, the name AOL still evokes the sound of dial-up internet, the link that got you to that series of tubes and kept you there inside AOL's walled internet garden. That strategy's eroded over the past few years. Now, AOL feeds content across dozens of sites, reaching 70 million users. Charlene Lee at the Altimeter Group says with its new unit called Media Glow, AOL is tearing down the walled garden for good, a sign of how much we've matured online.
And we're sophisticated now that we don't have to rely on one company, one place, one media site to provide all of that for us.
The change could indirectly increase ad revenue that many analysts say has been in decline. Now that AOL centrally supports its niche sites, Lee says advertisers can better target their audience.
Instead of selling generic advertising that anybody could sell, you're going to sell a unique audience.
AOL says it will develop 30 new websites this year, despite losses last year due to falling ad revenue. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Bring on the pow, bring on the zow. The great North American International Auto Show opened over the weekend, and okay, maybe not so much pow and zow this year. After all, this is an industry that not so long ago got rotten tomatoes thrown at it by an angry Congress, which then turned around and gave it a big check. And, well, what would it look like if the proceeds of that check went for pretty girls in long satin dresses, or short ones for that matter? Micheline Maynard covers the auto industry for the New York Times and joins us from Detroit. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tess.
Well, it's been kind of a downer year for Motor City, so what's the vibe like at this year's show?
Well, I think the vibe is much more serious than the car shows I've been to in the past. I mean, last year,
Chrysler put on a cattle drive on Washington Boulevard in front of the show. We've had Jeeps crashing through fake plate glass windows. We've had cars drop from the ceiling and nude models and all kinds of things like that. I think Mercedes had an ice rink last year, but we don't have any of that this year. It's definitely an all-business show in Detroit.
Well, one of the big concerns that Congress had when they agreed to bail out General Motors and Chrysler was that there would be real promises to turn out more efficient cars. Is there any sense that the automakers are starting to follow through on that?
Well, absolutely. Every car maker here, pretty much, at least the Detroit car makers, has made a real effort to demonstrate that they have seen the future, and it's hybrid electric and electric and alternative fuel vehicles. And not to be outdone, Toyota on Monday introduced the third generation of their Prius, and Honda has the Insight, which brings back the name of their original hybrid electric vehicle. So everywhere you look at the show, there are vehicles that are going to use a lot less gasoline.
Well, you mentioned the Prius and the Insight. I wonder if the impression that all these companies are trying to give is, you know, all this fuel efficiency, what is the reality for the other companies?
Well, what you have to remember is that General Motors is talking a lot about the Chevrolet Volt, which is a hybrid electric car that it plans to put on sale in late 2010. Ford was talking about a new electric vehicle that won't be available for a year or so after that. So we have a present that is still filled with big sedans and SUVs and crossover vehicles. Well, the future looks like it'll be hybrid electrics and other cars like that. The present is still filled with those big vehicles, and they're going to have to find a way to sell them until the future arrives.
Mickey, I wonder if there is any discussion there in Detroit about whether the fact that we're seeing, you know, oil prices come down so far, is the consumer still going to have the real desire to buy these fuel-efficient cars?
Robert Lutz, who is the vice chairman of General Motors, raised that issue here on Sunday. He said that, you know, we are doing our job in developing electric vehicles and in developing hybrid electric vehicles, but gas is below $2 a gallon in a lot of the country. It's just starting to creep up now. He said, we're going to have some help from the government. We'll develop all these vehicles if they want us to, but they need to also give us help in getting people to buy them when gas prices are low.
So for good or for bad, green really is the theme for this year for everyone, huh?
The Los Angeles Auto Show traditionally has been the green show because California is so interested in the environment. But this year, for sure, and for the first time I can remember, there's a green enveloping Detroit.
Michelle Maynard writes about cars for the New York Times. Thanks so much, and enjoy the show.
My pleasure. Happy New Year.
Losing a job can be the tipping point that drops people into poverty. And on that front, there is nothing good to report. The unemployment rate jumped to 7.2% in December. That's a 16-year high. So it's likely that hundreds of thousands of people will be looking for help with food and rent and medical bills. Social workers are there to provide resources, but a growing number want to tackle money issues head on. We asked reporter Kathy Duchamp to look into the idea of financial social work.
If you want to know what a financial social worker does, talk to Robin McKinney. She runs a nonprofit called Maryland Cash. It helps people do everything from open checking accounts to applying for tax credits. The mission, help families get financially stable.
I think it's the root of everything. I think if you have financial problems, then you're more likely to be depressed. You're more likely to have relationship problems, job instability. To me, it just gets at the core of all of it.
Social workers usually refer people with money problems to experts, credit counselors, volunteer tax preparers, or the occasional financial planner who does pro bono work. But McKinney kept seeing the same people coming through her door. She realized it was because no one was talking to them about underlying values and beliefs around money.
If someone has the underlying belief of, I don't deserve to have money,
it doesn't matter if you can find 10 extra dollars in their budget to go to their credit card. That's the underlying issue.
McKinney is now part of an emerging field of social workers taking the lead on money matters.
We might not be comfortable in the budgets or, you know, creating spending plans or helping someone with their credit report, but we know how to talk to people and support people around self-esteem issues.
But where are social workers learning about personal finance? McKinney didn't study it when she got her master's in social work. Finance isn't part of the regular curriculum. McKinney is changing that at her alma mater, the University of Maryland. The classes will be based on a course developed by the Center for Financial Social Work in North Carolina. It's the first in the country. Right now, the center offers its own online certification. Danielle Martinez got hers last summer. She's a case manager at Goodwill Staffing Services, a temp agency in Austin, Texas.
Every financial counseling session that I have, the light bulb goes on.
Martinez realized a lot of people couldn't get jobs because of bad credit. So she introduced the idea of financial counseling sessions to make her clients face their money demons.
I also make sure there are always tissues stocked in here because the sessions can be very emotional.
Especially for people who face barriers with the basics, like a bank rejecting you as a customer. She brings in a banker for especially tough cases, like people who are afraid to step into a bank.
For some reason, when the banker sits next to me, comes in and volunteers their time, they bring some sort of credibility that I don't have.
That's good news to certified financial planners who might be concerned about social workers dispensing money advice. Tim Maurer directs financial planning for the Financial Consulate. It's a firm in suburban Baltimore.
It's important that the people who step into that gray area do have some backing, some knowledge, and some education to make sure that they're not actually creating worse problems.
Maurer says the same goes for financial planners who are also stepping into that gray area. He wants to see social work and personal finance converge.
I think that the best financial planning programs already have begun to bring behavioral economics and more of that social worker counseling element into their curricula. And I think that that is the next level, that something we'll see over the next decade, these two groups, these two mindsets coming together.
Prompted by a faltering economy where emotional support could help everyone with money woes. I'm Kathy Duchamp from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the National Retail Federation is holding its annual convention in New York. In a speech to the gathered faithful, Walmart CEO H. Lee Scott warned against expecting a buying spree if and when the economy starts to recover. He noted that people are giving up all kinds of things like eating out and shopping. Sounds similar to previous recessions until you get to this part. Scott said customers are talking about how good they feel about their own pullback in spending. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shrank 125 points, 1.5%. The Nasdaq lost 32 points, slightly more than 2%. And the S&P 500 fell 20 points, 2.25%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, casinos in Macau gamble on their future.
It's always about build it and hope that they will come, and then when they don't come, then you get the spectacular collapses.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.